Hello, welcome to the rather delayed episode 20 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, Boardman has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that man and my name is Graham Lee. So apologies for the delay in this episode. I do tend to have a fairly flexible schedule, but also suffered from a lack of podcasting material for the last couple of weeks. Ironically, episode 19 was about I've just got a new Mac and how am I going to set it up. That was my work one, and I decided to go, while there is some syncing, it's mostly set up just for my work projects. It doesn't have my personal email, it doesn't have a lot of the apps I use for non-work purposes. And then removed the things that I do use for work purposes and work email from my personal computer. Well, recently that computer, my personal one, which was a 2018 15-inch MacBook Pro, died. It looks like the failure was the T2 chip that controls sort of all of the Apple-ness. You've got this Intel CPU that's doing the generic PC stuff, and then T2 doing the touch bar, the secure enclave, the sort of Apple innovations on the platform. And initially I was having trouble with it not shutting down correctly, because seemingly the T2 would crash. The computer would not be able to contact it to shut down. It would time out, kernel panic, and then that would be the end of it. Or it would get stuck and just stay in the shutting down state forever. And when I came back the next day, it was still trying to shut down and not doing that. Well, eventually it got to a point where it wouldn't turn on, and it wouldn't turn on enough to do an SMC reset. It wouldn't turn on enough to enter what's called DFU, device firmware update mode, which is the thing you can do to an iOS, iPad, or T2 running BridgeOS to sort of reflash the firmware. It wouldn't even do that. And this was sort of the week before, or maybe even the day before, the Apple new hardware announcement, the M1 series computers. So I thought, I'm just going to hold off. If they sell a Mac Mini in that initial launch, I'll get one of those, because then I'll have access to the Apple Silicon platform for porting my software and testing and all that kind of stuff. And I'll worry about fixing the laptop later. If they don't, then I'll fix the laptop now and get back to using that. Doesn't matter either way, I've got a Time Machine backup. So they did release the Mac Mini. I was quoted for fixing the laptop, it would have needed a logic board, because the components in these things are not designed for maintainability or for individual replaceability. It's not a very modular system. So actually the Mac Mini costs sort of same ballpark as fixing the laptop, so I haven't really lost out. And obviously once I've fixed the computer, the laptop, I'll be able to resell it anyway. My plan was get the Mac Mini, run the migration assistant, bring over my files from the Time Machine system, the Time Machine backup, carry on. What actually happened was that the migration assistant on Big Sur recognized my Time Machine backup as a Time Machine backup and recognized that it could use it as a migration source. But then when it went to migrate, decided that it, because it wasn't a bootable clone of a Mac hard disk, it didn't want to restore any files from it. So the migration assistant in Big Sur is broken. The long and short of it is I lost all of the files related to the podcast. So that's why there's a new recording of the theme music this episode, and that's why there's been a big delay as well. The other sort of factor is that in October I started a DPhil, which is basically Oxford's phrase that means PhD, in computer science. And I've been spending a lot of time doing like reading literature search and organizing my research question. So it's likely that the topic of the next 3 to 4 years of this podcast is going to be my sort of DPhil, and it is related to software engineering, so it's still going to be a software related podcast, but just like the thing that I'm going to be thinking about most of the time is going to be this research topic, and so that's going to be what comes out when I go to plan an episode. The topic that I proposed to my supervisors is about values, principles and practices in research software engineering. And I think I'm going to defer talking about research software engineering, or what I specifically mean about values, principles and practices, to a later episode. But what I want to do is sort of set the stage by thinking in general this episode about practices and values in software engineering, so sort of including the commercial software environment, and also like what we know about software engineering, so what there is in the world of software engineering research on which to build. And like that's going to be a fairly short episode, because what we know is very little. There's a good book that was recently released. It's free download by a guy called Derek Jones, Evidence-Based Software Engineering. And he identifies approximately 600 to 700 sources of data and analysis that are publicly available that are about software engineering that draw a conclusion from data. And he talks about all of them in this book. And you know, that's not even enough to bring a narrative together. And if you think that we've been doing software for like approximately 80 years, that the world relies heavily on software, particularly in what are called the weird social systems, that's westernized, educated, industrialized, rich and developed, or something like that. The amount to which computing is pervasive, the amount that is spent on computing, the amount of value that's generated by tech companies, the amount that governments and non-profits and NGOs and for-profits and clubs and all sorts of organizations, education establishments, everyone depends on software. And there's only a few hundred reports that make objective use of data in studying the field. It's kind of crazy how little is known. And so, he asks the question, why is there so little known about software engineering? And his answer is because it's a seller's market. Because there's so much money and value in software, there's no drive to understand it, to be better or more efficient at it, because you can always just take more money and carry on being inefficient. Which makes sense in the current world of software development, where there's so much, it's so easy to kind of create a software as a service and start charging your users for rent from day one, and so have a guaranteed revenue stream where you can then rent your computers from massive cloud providers, and they are incentivized to make sure that you are using those computers inefficiently, so that you're racking up your usage fees and so on. And also all of the money is sort of reinvested, financialized, financial services money through the hedge funds and venture capital funds and so on, that just spending more money in order to accumulate more money and capture more of the market and then accumulate even more money means there is no drive to actually sort of efficiently do software on the cheap, except hopefully in the context of research, where resources are a lot more limited and software is still instrumental. And then maybe in like other sectors like NGOs or non-profits, but where there isn't the money to research the more efficient techniques, and so you just have to take whatever the industry is giving you anyway. It also makes sense from a historical perspective. A lot of the sort of fundamental research into like engineering process and methodology started in the 60s, you know, the NATO Software Engineering Conference, and went through to sort of the 80s or so, people like Barry Beam. And it was being done by people who worked in like hardware and defense companies, or in like the big sort of enterprise IT companies. And enterprise IT deployments throughout that time were all about cost saving measures. They were about introducing computers into processes to replace long-winded manual tasks, to automate the workforce, to drive costs down. And so, you know, you do want to consider cost controlling projects, and you want to make sure that you are efficiently building the system that you intend to deploy and maintain. If you're in like a defense company or a hardware company, somewhere like IBM, then what you're selling is the hardware, you know, the computer that the missile simulation runs on, or the missile that the in-flight software runs on. The software is very much instrumental, and it is a cost center. Like the more it costs to develop the software, the lower the margins on your hardware, which is the thing that you're selling. So across these contexts, of course it makes sense to research how software is being made and how to do it better and therefore like more efficiently. Now that we're just in a world where like everything is made of commercial software, and you can very easily, as I said, get sort of software as a service rent from anybody, there's a lot less motivation to cut costs, because you know, you can always just do cost plus pricing on a subscription basis and realize a profit from very early on, a small amount of seed money, and you're already generating revenue. I think there's also an argument that for many in development, and I include like myself and a lot of my peers who got into software development because they're excited by the possibilities of programming on like 1980s microcomputers or 1990s platforms like the Amiga and the Atari ST and the Mac and the Acorn, Archimedes and so on. For a lot of us, software development in our career is basically monetizing our interests and passions. You know, we've got this sort of hobby and we found that we can go and make fairly decent salaries. Like, you know, I'm now in a university, obviously, and my salary is significantly lower than it has been when I've worked for Silicon Valley firms, for example. There is a lot of money out there for someone who wants to be a software engineer. But if what I want to do is like, you know, learn all about Swift and talk about Swift at conferences and find best Swift practices and that kind of thing, I'm not going to be objective or dispassionate about evaluating whether Swift adoption is a good idea or whether there are more efficient ways to write to write like graphical applications than Swift UI, for example, because I have this sort of emotional investment and passion in it. It, which is great for producing communities of practice, because then you've got you can build networks of a lot of people who all share these interests, and so can all learn from each other, and therefore develop newer and potentially better ways of doing things, but maybe not so good for evaluating whether those newer ways are in fact better. So a lot of the things that we say we know in software engineering are at best outdated, because they're things that were produced a long time ago in a different context. We may think of like the mythical Man Month, adding developers to a late project, or adding people in general to a late project can only make it later. Well, that was true for Fred Brooks back when he wrote that, and his reflections on the IBM System 360 project. But we no longer have projects. yeah, we no longer add people to a late project. We now add people to the next sprint. We add people to the next iteration. Does that make the project later? Can the project be later? Does it have a finish date? You know, we're doing incremental and iterative development where every 2 weeks or every however long your iteration is, we deliver like new valuable software to our customer. Is there a way that that can be late? And so do we still know that adding people to a late project makes it later? Does any of that sentence even make sense to a modern software development endeavor? But worse than that, worse than being outdated and potentially not generalizable from the context in which the truisms are formulated into the context in which we find ourselves today, some of these things are just, you know, fully unsubstantiated. And there's this great book by Lauren Bossavy, which I'll link, called The Leprechauns of Software Engineering. Leprechauns being, of course, mythical creatures, where he looks at the supposed evidence behind a lot of the mythology in software engineering. And, you know, the sort of example for this is the 10X programmer. And this is one I looked into myself on the SICPA's blog, in an apology to readers of test-driven iOS development. And I'll put a link to that article in the notes as well. What you are hearing now is me writing that statement to link the show notes in my outline for the show, because I've realized on reviewing the episodes that I've recorded so far that I often say, and I'll put a link to this in the show notes, and then there is no link in the show notes. Well, now I've written down that I'm going to write that link in the show notes. It will appear in the show notes. Good. So, Leprechauns of Software Engineering, Laurent Bossavy talks about 10x developers. And there is, when you look at the literature, there are many sources, but they're all sort of interlinked citations of each other, and then we come down to a single report written by someone who was at a defense contractor in the US, where what they were doing was comparing whether online debugging, by which they mean using a terminal in front of a live computer, is better than fast, by which they mean faster than offline debugging, by which they mean submitting your software as a batch job to a remote system and then going up and picking up a printout a while later. In terms of like the speed taken to sort of debug a particular task. In fact, they have a couple of tasks. So they have people assigned to task A using an online programming system and an offline programming system, and people assigned to task B using an online and offline programming system. What they discovered was that, yes, online debugging is better than offline debugging. Maybe that data, maybe that result is the reason that we no longer use batch systems anymore and that we've all got computers on our desks. Regardless, what they also found was large individual variations in performance. This idea, and I think that the numbers were up to sort of 26 or 28 times between like best performer at some particular task and worst performer at some particular task in this, like, you know, sort of very narrow study. This idea has been like telephone game communicated until it becomes A, the much easier number to work with, 10, and B, the idea that some programmers are just 10 times better than some other programmers. Not that sometimes a debugging task can be completed 28 times faster by one individual than by another individual. You know, maybe they were programmers of equal capability and both came up with hypotheses that were reasonable and one of them happened to get the correct hypothesis first time. Or you know, maybe this person had just been, maybe one of them had just been fixing a similar bug at work. We don't even know whether they were necessarily working or whether they were, you know, what experience they had. Maybe they were students, maybe they were professionals, we don't know. But it's become this idea that there are people who are just intrinsically 10 times better at programming than other people. Which, of course, doesn't translate to all of the other things that you have to be able to do when you're a programmer in order to deliver quality software, like talking to your customers and understanding what their requirements are. Are these 10x programmers, which don't exist, 10 times better at communicating with customers than other programmers? Well, perhaps not, because, you know, programmers still like to say that they prefer to be in the flow, like the mental flow space, and not have meetings. How do they know what their customer is, you know, what their customer wants if they're not going to meetings? So a lot of what we claim to know about software engineering at best comes from the 80s and may not apply 40 years later, and at worst wasn't even true when it was written back then. And I suspect that in the evaluation of the sort of cost-benefit trade-off of software engineering and whether it's worth investing effort into researching better practices, I suspect that Agile has a lot to answer for here, and particularly the ideas that were already sort of prevalent in the industry before they got this unifying call of Agile software development, of iterative and incremental delivery. Because before there was Agile, there was the software crisis, which was often referred to as software's perpetual crisis, because I think it had first been written in either the 68 or the 69 NATO conference, and was then, you know, used as justification for like silver bullet methodologies, for interventions, consultancy in software ever since. This idea that a large fraction, possibly a majority, of software projects got cancelled without ever delivering something to their customers. And of course, like, this was bad. You know, the idea that we were spending a lot on software without delivering any software, that is evidently a situation that you want to fix. And so, you know, maybe that's where all this research into methodology and running software projects came from. But once you've got iterative and incremental development, once you've got continuous delivery and minimal viable products, all of these things are designed with the idea in mind that you get value to the customer early, which is definitely good. Like, that means that as soon as you've got something ready that is going to be valuable to your customer, or that you hypothesize would be valuable to the customer, you try it out. Now, does that, in addition to getting like a smaller increment of value to your customer earlier, which we believe is probably a good thing, does that also mean that projects that aren't run particularly well no longer get cancelled? Does it mean that because we've already given the first slightly crappy version of the thing, the minimum viable product, to the customer, and we've promised to iterate on it and to improve it, does that anchor them onto this project, mentally onto this product? Does it introduce a sort of sunk cost fallacy and a sort of anti-switching bias that means that this project is more likely to survive even if it doesn't, in scare quotes, succeed? Which would be a bad thing. It would mean a greater survival of lower quality software. Does it mean that we have turned the sorts of development activities and efforts that previously led into have been going for 9 months, haven't delivered, we're going to cancel, into have some number of deliveries, have some number of customers, we're going to keep at this until we work it out? Does the fact that we're cancelling fewer bad projects mean that there are fewer bad projects, or that there are fewer cancellations? So is Agile actually the survival mechanism, or let's be more specific about this, is the practice of frequent delivery of software to customers that is one of the practices which is or principles which is mentioned in the Agile Software Development Manifesto, is that idea of frequent delivery the survival mechanism for bad engineering practices rather than the good engineering practice? That's the question I'm going to leave with you with. I'm definitely interested in talking about it, so please get in touch. Graham Lee at acm.org. Twitter, I was Lee G, IWASLEEG. Thank you very much, and I will talk to you again next time, which hopefully won't be as far into the future.